I went to the first Al-Qaeda address, and they said the Arabs had moved from that building across the street to another building. So I went to that building. There was a chart on the wall how you could promote yourself in Al-Qaeda by doing these courses and moving up the ranks. Ahmed, my Afghan friend who had worked with Al-Qaeda, said that one of the houses was bin Laden's wife's house. He didn't say which wife. From the outside, it was pretty bland and run down, but most buildings in Afghanistan were run down in those days anyway. I found the owner, who actually lived next door, luckily a very nice chap who let me in. He had no idea the bin Laden family had been living there. He said a Yemeni family were living there. I used to live in Kabul before. I thought, why not get a house again? John Simpson suggested that people might like to stay in the bin Laden house. My first idea wasn't to make a hotel. It was really to make a house for myself. The landlord was very happy because the Osamas had been paying $150 a month, but they left owing 3 months' rent. As far as the landlord was concerned, it was Yemenis who rented it. There were women there, and he didn't really engage in conversation with them. They were very unfriendly to anybody who was too interested. The gardener was not allowed to work there at all, who's now, again, working for me. I went to the second place. It used to be the Saudi embassy before, so I went into the basement of that building. It was very interesting. They had all these seats all around the walls so they could face in. And there was all this stuff all on the floor, clothing, paperwork, drugs, you know, aspirin and stuff like that. A few syringes, but no narcotics. It's forbidden. Obviously, this had been used as a center for Arabs coming into fight fairly soon after 9/11. When the Americans were building up the operation to go into Afghanistan, I think quite a lot of Arabs came into Afghanistan to support the Taliban. Some of them brought these ridiculously big suitcases as if they were going on holiday. And a tie would be put on it with a number, and then they would put all their personal effects in it. Then they would get into their gear, and off they would go. The Afghans had got into that building and ransacked it and taken all the good clothes, so there was just munitions, passports, box cutters, which I had never seen before in my life. I was a bit more aware of them after 9/11, but a few of those were around as well. I filmed all this, and John did a piece to camera walking through all this debris. It was quite strange because there was electricity in the building and a sauna. It wasn't being used. All these Al-Qaeda houses were really basic, pretty dirty, not even painted. There was these grey blankets on the ground as carpets, mattresses around the wall. There was always a musty smell. There was always a pile of dried bread somewhere in the corner because they never chuck bread away because it's a sin. So they were in there for the hardship, the harder the better. A bit like Lawrence of Arabia. They wanted to test themselves. I think it was more out of conviction, not out of necessity. They could have bought a tin of paint. It doesn't take much to smarten up a place. They came there to do the jihad, not to live in luxury. Vahid Mojeh, the former Taliban foreign ministry official, recalls the fall of the Taliban. In a gathering a few days before the start of the American air attack on Afghanistan, Mullah Omar said to a group of his companions, "You may consider me weak or scared, but I have to send my family to Pakistan." Up until this point, the Taliban thought that even if Mullah Omar lacks other good qualities, at least he was both pious and courageous. But now he was showing the first lapse into weakness. Despite the fact the Pakistan government had turned its back on the Taliban, thousands of people from Pakistan's tribal areas were willing to join the jihad against the Americans in Afghanistan. These people thought, as the Taliban did, that they would be engaging American troops in a land war face to face. When America's heavy aerial bombardment started, the Taliban fighters maintained their ranks for several weeks against it. After those weeks passed, the situation in the north became critical, and many of the Pakistani volunteers freshly arrived in Afghanistan were sent to Mazar-i-Sharif in northern Afghanistan, even though they had no knowledge of the lay of the land. Mullah Omar's hope was that by sending these troops to the north, the problem would subside. In Kandahar, the conviction was that the resistance would continue. But slowly, the intense bombardment made the situation very difficult for Mullah Omar. He was forced to spend his nights in open spaces or places where he had not been seen, spotted at before. even though Mullah Omar was officially in charge of the military. In fact, he had no contact with the front, because he was afraid his location would be pinpointed and bombed. But the Taliban leaders would take no orders from anyone except Mullah Omar. Mullah Nouri, the northern zone commander, would scream in one such call, "We are under aerial bombardment. The lines at Mazar-i-Sharif are being attacked from the ground, and inside the city there is an uprising forming. Mullah Omar must tell me what to do." The Taliban feared the anger of the populace more than anything. They had never tried to gain popular support and were fully aware that people would avenge all the torture and hardship they had suffered at their hands at the first opportunity. This is a destiny common to all tyrannical regimes upon defeat. In Kandahar, Mullah Omar had resorted to fortune-telling and dream interpretation to aid him in his decisions. He told his commanders to continue fighting because America would soon be destroyed. But the destruction of America kept all waiting while the destruction of Kandahar became a reality. Mullah Omar finally gave up dreaming and decided to abandon Kandahar. He reached this conclusion after the American planes destroyed all the forces he had sent to retake Uruzgan province, Mullah Omar's home province. Feroz Ali Abbasi, the Ugandan Briton who was captured in Pakistan after the fall of the Taliban. After September 11th, most of the English-speaking brothers remained in the guest house in Kandahar. I became more and more frustrated with just sitting around weaponless and defenseless, expecting imminent attack. Saif al-Adl, al-Qaeda's number two military commander, gave all of us three options. You can either go to Kabul, or remain in Kandahar with the mountain group or the airport group. The airport group was the most dangerous. Which one do you want? Everybody, including me, went for the most dangerous, the airport group. Camp Obaidah, where we would be located, was a short distance away from the airport. I was in civilian clothes and weaponless. I decided to do some scavenging, looking through the camp for anything that would increase my chance of survival in the coming fight. I changed out of my civilian clothes into military threads. I was about the only one who did this. The premise behind the Mujahideen wearing civil clothes, one actually told me this, was he could try to play that he is a civilian if things got too heated. The rest of the time, before the bombing, I went scavenging to increase my arsenal of weapons. Allied planes came on Sunday night, 7th of October. I had been expecting them to bomb on the Tuesday coming because I had heard nearly a month ago that a fax had been sent to Osama bin Laden from an individual in America who had a fax line with Osama bin Laden. I had known this since basic training when Osama bin Laden had come to talk in the mosque and mentioned the warning that America was going to bomb in 1 month's time. Even funnier is how the Americans broadcasted to the media the fact that they had told the Northern Alliance to ground its planes, telegraphing that they were coming. Maybe just in case Osama bin Laden hadn't quite packed and left yet. Anyway, the bombing started, and I spent the rest of the time at the airport running around like a madman out in the middle of nowhere trying to dodge missiles which seemed to ever come closer. Possibly on the 17th of Ramadan, December 3rd, 2001, the opposition Pashtun forces attempted to take over the airport area. There was a gunfight that went on into the night. Possibly on the 19th of Ramadan, the Pashtun forces made another attack and this time gained ground significantly upon us. We were pushed back to another line of cover. Most of Afghanistan had fallen. Only Kandahar and Tora Bora and possibly another Taliban stronghold in the north that was under siege were in the Mujahideen hands. Maybe thoughts of run today to fight another day were creeping into the Mujahideen's minds. I was following what Mullah Omar had said, which was translated/relayed to me. All the Mujahideen are to retreat back to Kandahar. From here we either spread out and retake Afghanistan or we die here. I had taken it literally, death or victory. The group that had adopted me were staying in a dry riverbed. I was teamed with one Yemeni guy who had all but given up listening to my baby Arabic and was enthralled by looking out for an American helicopter. But one morning I woke up at dawn, and none of them were there. They had all fled. An unidentified Guantanamo Bay detainee before a U.S. military tribunal. As the recorder read the unclassified summary to the tribunal, the detainee stated each point was correct. Whatever evidence was brought against me, I admit to. I've been telling the same story, and I'm not lying about it. I helped out bin Laden. My word is what I said. I am going to tell the truth. I helped Redacted, and I have been with Osama bin Laden. I agreed to the evidence. I did this for money. For 5 years, I have been a member of the Taliban, and when the Americans came, Redacted was giving money to finance attacks on Americans. We were told by the Arabs, who had all the money, that they were planning an attack on the United States with 20 pilots. This is the first story. I was working for money. The second story is, Redacted was with me. We went to Jalalabad. Bin Laden was in Jalalabad, and we took him up to the Pakistan border. It's a way that nobody knows. It's a secret. We left bin Laden and his family at the Pakistani border, and we came back. They, bin Laden and his family, disappeared. This is the story of Al-Qaeda that I took part in. Questioned by a tribunal member. Do you consider the United States an enemy? Answer. I worked for money. Other people would tell me Americans were bad, but I never thought about Americans. I just did it for the money. Fuad al-Rabiya is a 45-year-old Kuwaiti held in Guantanamo who had met bin Laden in June 2001. 4 months later, he was back in Afghanistan as the United States was launching its attack on the Taliban. Al-Rabiya says he intended only a short visit to Afghanistan, but got sucked in by the war. He provides a vivid account of Al-Qaeda's retreat to the mountains of Tora Bora in eastern Afghanistan near the city of Jalalabad. During that time, no one would rent a house to an Arab for fear of being shot or bombed. They would let us stay at their house for a couple of days as a courtesy. So we were moving from one house to the other every few days, looking for a way to get out. We were then told we had to go to the north to Jalalabad. There was supposed to be a way out from there, so we went to Jalalabad looking for the way out. Now the country is falling. No one believed the country would fall so quickly, within 1 week. So you can imagine the chaos that was going on there. The vehicles leaving Jalalabad were full of people who were like luggage thrown on top of each other. We went to a house on the edge of Jalalabad that belonged to a person called Abdul Quddus. He turned out to be a very big man in Al-Qaeda. We took everything in the house with us and we left because Jalalabad fell. There was no more control. Simply being out on the street was an invitation to be killed. We walked from there to the baseline edge of the mountains. Those mountains were the border mountains known as the Tora Bora Mountains. This was an escape route to get out of the country because it is the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. That was the only way to get out. Up in the mountains, there was bombing night and day. All the way up the mountain, I could hear children, I could hear men, I could see small children walking around. The mountains were filled with civilians fleeing the area. I reached the top of the mountain. Then Abdul Quddus gave the order that everybody go because we feared snow was coming. The roads would be blocked. Dr. Mohammed Asif Kazizanda is the deputy governor of Narangarh province, in which Tora Bora is located. Dr. Kazizanda, a veterinarian by training, spent years fighting the Soviets in Tora Bora and would encounter bin Laden on several occasions during the jihad against the communists between 1989 and 1991, observing, at that time, he was very well respected. His historical perspective about Tora Bora explains why bin Laden retreated there. I was the deputy commander in Tora Bora from 1980 to 1983 when I was in my early 20s. We made machine gun emplacements and installed anti-aircraft guns. It was difficult for the Russians to attack us because of the caves and shelters built into the mountains. Tora Bora had easy access to Pakistan because there were paths by foot to Parachinar, a parrot's beak of Pakistani territory that juts into Afghanistan. I witnessed many offensives by the Soviets against Tora Bora. At one time, 2,000 Russian and 2,000 Afghan communist soldiers mounted an offensive against Tora Bora, supported by 50 Russian helicopters and MiG jets. we shot down two of the helicopters with machine guns and captured a soldier from the Ukraine. During the jihad against the Soviets, we had a force of 120 to 130 people stationed in Tora Bora. There are two reasons the Arabs fled to Tora Bora after 9/11. First, it was difficult for the Americans to attack, and there was a way to escape Tora Bora into Pakistan. Commander Mohammad Musa is an Afghan militia leader who commanded frontline troops at the Battle of Tora Bora. Musa is the brother-in-law of Hazrat Ali, who was one of the overall commanders of the battle. When I interviewed him in the summer of 2003, Musa told me that he had met bin Laden in 1991 without providing any further details. A decade later, he would be leading soldiers into battle to dislodge al-Qaeda's leader from his Tora Bora hideout. When we moved from Jalalabad to Tora Bora, I had 600 men with me. When we started the attack, for 1 week we couldn't make any advance. They were on the mountains sending rockets at us. It was very hard fighting with them. They were hiding in their posts, and we were in the open. They had rockets, submachine guns. Al-Qaeda fought very hard with us. When we captured them, they committed suicide with grenades. I saw three of them do that myself. Over our radios, they were telling us, "You must not fight with us. We don't want to fight against you. You are Muslims." The very hardest fighters were the Chechens, who were resistant to the end. On December 12, 2001, Haji Zaman, another Afghan commander, told me about a ceasefire with the Arabs. Al-Qaeda wanted to escape from a particular village, Galanjali village in the mountains. Al-Qaeda said, "We want to surrender to the United Nations. We want a ceasefire." Zaman said, "We'll accept a ceasefire at 4 p.m. in the afternoon." That night, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban all escaped to Pakistan. We only captured 13 people who escaped. We did not want the ceasefire to happen. It was Haji Zaman who agreed to it. U.S. forces were not involved in the fighting. They had some guys with us to coordinate the bombing. There were six American soldiers with us, U.S. Special Forces. They coordinated the airstrikes. The American bombardment was very effective, very precise bombing of Al-Qaeda's positions, very useful in that way. My personal view is if the Americans had blocked the way out to Pakistan, Al-Qaeda would not have had a way to escape. The Americans were my guest here, but they didn't know about fighting, how to do it. At the end of the battle, the Americans gave me four or five Datsun four-wheel drive vehicles. Four of my men died, and eight were injured. Peter Juvenal, the former British Army officer turned combat cameraman, covered the Tora Bora battle for ABC News. America's special forces are very good generally, but the mistake they made at Tora Bora was they relied on Afghans for information, and so it was pretty easy for Osama to slip out. It's no criticism of the special forces. I think there weren't enough of them on the ground. I only actually saw around 12 special forces guys. The Americans had a very successful war with a very small number of special forces guys, and I don't think psychologically they were ready to commit so many troops to the ground. Maybe there was too much of an emphasis put on the SF, who did a brilliant job. They got rid of the Taliban regime. But this is a fox you are after, so you have to put a lot of boots on the ground. The question of whether the United States missed an opportunity to capture or kill bin Laden during the Battle of Tora Bora in eastern Afghanistan in December 2001 became an issue in the razor-close 2004 U.S. presidential campaign. During the September 30, 2004 presidential debate, Democratic contender Senator John Kerry said of capturing bin Laden, "He escaped in the mountains of Tora Bora. We had him surrounded." Writing in the New York Times 2 weeks later, General Tommy Franks, a Bush supporter and the overall commander of the Tora Bora operation, wrote, "We don't know to this day whether Mr. bin Laden was at Tora Bora." At a town hall meeting in Ohio on October 19th, Vice President Dick Cheney said Kerry's critique of the Tora Bora campaign was absolute garbage. President Bush himself weighed in on the question of bin Laden's Tora Bora presence, or lack thereof, at a campaign rally a week before the election, saying, "It's part of Kerry's pattern of saying anything it takes to get elected. Like when he charged that our military failed to get Osama bin Laden at Tora Bora, even though our top military commander, General Tommy Frank, said the senator's understanding of events does not square with reality, and intelligence reports place bin Laden in any of several different countries at the time." However, according to a widely reported background briefing by Pentagon officials in mid-December 2001, there was reasonable certainty that bin Laden was indeed at Tora Bora, a judgment based on intercepted radio transmissions. Indeed, General Tommy Franks recounted in his autobiography, American Soldier, that in Texas in December 2001, he briefed President Bush saying, "Unconfirmed reports that Osama has been seen in the White Mountains, sir, the Tora Bora area." In June 2003, I met with several senior U.S. counterterrorism officials who explained, "We are confident that he, bin Laden, was at Tora Bora and disappeared with a small group." Also, Gary Berntsen, the CIA official in charge of the Tora Bora operation for the agency, has publicly said that bin Laden was in the Tora Bora area during the battle. The following accounts further establish that bin Laden was at Tora Bora. Peter Juvenal: "I was told by some Afghan friends of mine that Osama was in Tora Bora. This is a day or so before the Northern Alliance took Kabul on November 12, 2001. The information originally came from bin Laden's Afghan driver. Later, I organized a vehicle to take me, and we went up to Tora Bora. I did some interviews with Arabs captured in Tora Bora by a local Afghan commander. They had been captured at night, and they were really exhausted. They were kept in a little house under guard, and they let me in, and they were all asleep. They were just crashed out. One was black. Must have been from Sudan or something like that. And these chaps, four of them, wearing Pakistani winter clothing, snotty noses, they'd obviously caught colds up in the mountains. They weren't used to cold weather. They had long johns on. They'd been living off this Nestle baby food. I found tins of this Nestle baby food up in the mountains, yogurt and honey and stuff. They must have had the runs all the time. So my first concern was that these men were going to wake up, and I was clean-shaven with a mustache, so they're going to wake up and think the American army is here." I have a picture of Peter Bergen and myself with Osama bin Laden together from CNN's 1997 interview. I knew that it would be useful one day. It was very dark, and I had to get one of these gas lamps and move it around to see them. They were all crashed out. They'd been captured that night. This must have been 9 o'clock that morning. They hadn't slept for 2 days, so I woke one of them up. I didn't want to wake all four up, because they might attack me, though I did have one Afghan in the room with me. So I woke one of them up, the Arab-looking one. He was a bit startled, so I showed the picture of Peter Bergen, Osama, and myself, and explained who I was. I asked him, "Have you seen bin Laden? Is he around?" And after seeing the picture, he relaxed a bit and spoke good English. He said they'd seen bin Laden a few days before, but had no information on where he was now. Abu Jafar al-Kuwaiti was an eyewitness to the U.S. airstrikes on Tora Bora in early December 2001. Bin Laden is believed to have fled the area and escaped around December 10th. Excerpts of Abu Jafar's account, which was posted to al-Qaeda's main website on the first anniversary of 9/11, follow. November 14, 2001. Mujahid Sheikh Osama bin Laden and his special group arrived to the area 9,000 feet above sea level in the Tora Bora Mountains with its extreme terrain and cold weather. We were with him. This position had more than 15 trenches to protect the Mujahideen from the insane American strikes that started 5 days before. The trenches were built by our hands and effort and by our brothers, the Afghan Mujahideen. But because we needed a large number of trenches, Brother Faris and Abdul Qudos requested the assistance of the nearby tribes to help them continue this effort. The men of the tribes kept coming to us. Then we witnessed the increase in flights of drones, U.S. Predator drones, that did not leave the area night or day. on December 9th, at a late hour of the night, we were awakened to the sound of massive and terrorizing explosions very near to us. It was the place where the trench of Sheikh Osama bin Laden was. The night past was very long and very worrisome, as we waited for what the morning would bring to see what this barbaric raid had done. In the morning, we received the horrifying news. The trench of Sheikh Osama had been destroyed. The trench where Sheikh used to come out every day to check the Mujahideen situation and follow the news of the battle. But God kept Osama bin Laden alive because he left the bunker only two nights before to an area only 200 meters away. Abdullah Tabarak, a Moroccan who was bin Laden's driver, was detained by both Pakistani and U.S. authorities in December 2001 and was later sent from Guantanamo to his native Morocco in August 2004 to face trial. Following the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, I left Kandahar in the company of bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and a number of guards in the direction of Kabul through Jalalabad, and afterward we returned to Kabul once again. After its fall, we returned once again to Jalalabad. During the month of Ramadan in the same year, we entered Tora Bora, where we stayed for 20 days. From there, Ayman al-Zawahiri fled, accompanied by Uthman, the son of Osama bin Laden. Afterwards, bin Laden fled with his son Mohammed, accompanied by Afghan guards, while I fled with a group made up mainly of Yemenis and Saudis in the direction of Pakistan. We were arrested by the Pakistani authorities at a border checkpoint, and they handed us over to the U.S. authorities, who deported us to the Guantanamo detention camp in Cuba. Osama bin Laden himself recounted his experiences at Tora Bora on an audio tape that aired on Al Jazeera on February 11th, 2003. Now I am going to tell you a part of that great battle of Tora Bora so that I will prove to you how cowardly the Americans are. We were only 300 fighters. We had already dug 100 trenches spread out in a space that didn't exceed 1 square mile. On the morning of the 17th of Ramadan, December 3rd, 2001, very heavy bombing started, especially after the American leadership made sure that some of the leaders of Al-Qaeda were in Tora Bora, including myself and the Mujahid brother Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri. The bombing became around the clock. Not a second would pass without a fighter plane passing over our heads day and night. American forces were bombing us by smart bombs that weigh thousands of pounds and bombs that penetrate caves and other kinds of bombs that enter into caves. The fighter bombers, like B-52s, each one of them goes over our heads for 2 hours, and in every time it drops between 20 and 30 bombs. That was in addition to the forces of the Northern Alliance, whom they pushed to attack us for a continuous month. We fought back against all their attacks, and we defeated them every time. In spite of all that, American forces did not dare to go into our posts. What sign is more than that of their cowardice? With all its forces that were fighting against a small group of Mujahideen, 300 Mujahideen in the trenches, inside 1 square mile, in -10 degrees of temperature. The result of the battle was that we lost 6% of our force, 18 men. A visibly aged bin Laden spoke on a videotape that aired on December 27, 2001, his choice of words seeming to confirm his recent brush with death at Tora Bora. Bin Laden, who is left-handed, did not move his entire left side in the 34-minute audio tape, strongly suggesting he had sustained a serious injury during the battle. I am just a poor slave of God. If I live or die, the war will continue. Abdul Bari Atwan spent 2 days interviewing bin Laden in Tora Bora in 1996. I wasn't surprised Osama was in Tora Bora. I expected him to be there. I was in the Gulf region and I met somebody from Al-Qaeda, and he told me that Osama bin Laden was injured during the Tora Bora bombing and he was operated on his left shoulder. And then when I saw his first videotape immediately after Tora Bora, I said, "Something is wrong with his left shoulder. His left shoulder was very stiff, and he couldn't move his left hand." And many people from Al-Qaeda actually were extremely furious I said that publicly, because they don't want him to be reported as injured. Why did the United States military, the most powerful armed force in history, not seal off the Tora Bora region, instead relying only on a handful of U.S. special forces on the ground? Historians will no doubt be debating that question for many years, but part of the answer is that the U.S. military was a victim of its own success. Scores of U.S. special forces soldiers calling in airstrikes, in combination with thousands of Afghans on the ground, destroyed the Taliban army in a few weeks of fighting, a textbook case of unconventional warfare. However, this approach was a failure at Tora Bora, where large numbers of Americans on the ground were needed to throw up an effective cordon around Al-Qaeda's leaders. An implicit recognition of this fact can be seen in how the Pentagon approached Operation Anaconda in central Afghanistan 3 months after Tora Bora. In the Anaconda operation, the very name of which suggests an effective cordon, as many as 1,000 U.S. soldiers were deployed into an area near Gurdaz in eastern Afghanistan to do battle with hundreds of Taliban and Al-Qaeda soldiers. Apologists for the U.S. military failure at Tora Bora will no doubt provide some reasons why this was the case, including a lack of airlift capabilities from the U.S. airbase known as K-2 in neighboring Uzbekistan. However, such explanations are hard to square with the fact that scores of journalists managed to find their way to Tora Bora, a battle covered on live television by the world's leading news organizations. If Fox News and CNN could arrange for their crews to cover Tora Bora, it is puzzling that the U.S. military could not put more boots on the ground to entrap the hardcore of Al-Qaeda. Sadly, there were more American journalists at the Battle of Tora Bora than there were U.S. soldiers. In sum, the Tora Bora battle was a missed opportunity to bring bin Laden to justice.